Lecture 27, The Free Exercise Clause, Acting on Beliefs.
In this lecture, we take up the problems associated with the Free Exercise Clause, and as we shall see, those problems are no less difficult, no less complex than the problems the Court has had to wrestle with the Establishment Clause. Western liberal constitutionalism and the tradition of tolerance that we inherit from John Locke seem to require some degree of freedom of conscience in any constitutional democracy. And as is true with the Establishment Clause, there is at least one undisputed understanding of the Free Exercise Clause. The state may not punish individuals for holding or rejecting particular religious beliefs. When one acts on a belief, however, he or she is more likely to bump up against the rights of others or the interest of the community at large. And consider, at what point should the community's interest, say in public order or public morality, restrict an individual's right to the free exercise of religion? We begin in this lecture with the Court's earliest cases, which I have previewed for you before. Many of those cases, you'll recall, involve the fledgling Mormon Church. In the earlier lecture, when we considered these cases, in particular when we considered Davis versus Beeson, our purpose in examining them was to consider how the Court wrestled with the problem of definition. And we saw that the Court's earliest definitions tended to be theistically centered and perhaps Christian as well. We're not so much interested in the definitional issue with the free exercise question. We take up the Mormon cases now in this lecture for a different reason. Imagine the following kind of difficulty. I may believe anything I want. Under what conditions am I free to act on my belief? The earliest cases, the Mormon cases, as we shall see, wrestled with precisely that problem. Every exercise of an individual freedom, and perhaps especially those associated with the Free Exercise Clause, must take place in a larger community. In Reynolds versus the United States, decided in 1878, the first Mormon case, the Court considered the constitutionality of a congressional statute that prohibited polygamy in the United States territories. In that case, the Court first began to suggest that there might be a constitutionally relevant distinction between what one believes and how one acts. So, the Court continued with this in the important case of Davis versus Beeson. Davis said a lot of things, or I should say Justice Field, writing for the Court in Davis versus Beeson, said a lot of things, and I think it is important, again, to get a sense of what the case was all about and to get a sense of how the Court approached the underlying issues. And I hope you will recall that the underlying issue was the constitutionality not only of the act of polygamy, but the very belief in polygamy. Justice Field wrote the following: "Bigamy and polygamy are crimes by the laws of all civilized and Christian countries." He continued, "They tend to destroy the purity of the marriage relation, to disturb the peace of families, to degrade woman, and to debase man." And if you haven't quite got the full tenor of the point Justice Field wants to make, he concludes, "To call their advocacy a tenet of religion is to offend the common sense of mankind." One might add, apparently not to offend the common sense of believers of the Mormon faith, but their common sense apparently doesn't factor into this equation at all. Now, the real critical part for this lecture is what Justice Field went on to say. And I want to quote this important part of his opinion, and we really need to understand this quote in some detail. I begin with the following from his opinion. "It was never intended or supposed that the amendment," he means the Free Exercise Clause, "could be invoked as a protection against legislation for the punishment of acts inimical to the peace, good order, and morals of society." He continues, "While legislation for the establishment of a religion is forbidden and its free exercise permitted, it does not follow that everything which may be called a religion can be tolerated." Now, I'm not sure precisely what to make of the second quote that I read you. That second quote could be read in a way sufficiently expansive to suggest that there are some things you may not even believe under the rubric of the Free Exercise Clause, but I don't think Justice Field meant to go that far. And as I have said before, if there is one absolute unqualified right that exists in the American constitutional order, it is that you have the right to believe, at least under the Free Exercise Clause, anything you want to believe. Indeed, I find it difficult to imagine a situation, any situation, in which the government could constitutionally punish you for believing or refusing to believe anything. I just cannot imagine a hypothetical set of facts in which belief alone could be punished without violating the Free Exercise Clause. Now, as it turns out, what became critical to Justice Field was the first part of the quotation that I suggested. It was never intended or supposed that the amendment could be invoked as protection against legislation. Here, Justice Field introduces, for the first time in the court's free exercise jurisprudence, the idea that there is a constitutionally relevant distinction between what one believes and how one behaves. And scholars and judges together know this as the so-called belief-conduct distinction. And just so there is no misunderstanding about this, the belief-conduct distinction stands for the proposition that freedom of belief is absolutely and perhaps universally protected, but conduct is not. Now, in the very opening to this lecture, I suggested that part of our understanding of the Free Exercise Clause will trace itself back, or should trace itself back, to that Lockean tradition of tolerance that we associate with Western liberal constitutionalism more generally. It may also be the case, or at least so some scholars argue, that that Lockean tradition of tolerance rests upon a particular understanding of religion. It rests upon an understanding that makes religion fundamentally an affair of the soul and a private affair of the soul. Hence, in the privacy of your own heart, in the privacy of your own mind, you may believe whatever you like. But the moment your belief transcends the private arena and moves into the public square, according to the belief-conduct distinction, at that moment, your right to believe has been transformed into a right to act, and that second right, the right to act, is one that at least on some conditions and in some circumstances, the state may choose to regulate. At another part in Davis versus Beeson, Justice Field suggests that it would be truly extraordinary that a law of general applicability that criminalized certain behavior would not apply to members of a particular religious faith just because they believed differently. And again, they may believe whatever they like, but they may not act necessarily on it. I want to return to that at the very end of the lecture, but by way of preview, it is probably worth recalling that the language itself of the Free Exercise Clause doesn't suggest the belief-conduct distinction. And if one were to be literalist about it, one might suggest that the free exercise of religion implies a kind of active approach to religion. It suggests more than simply belief. And the framers might well have said, some scholars have argued, that if they wanted only to protect belief, the framers might well have said that. They certainly could have said it. There isn't any reason in the world why they couldn't have simply said, we protect freedom of religious belief, and left it at that. One final point from Davis versus Beeson, Justice Field's majority opinion. He wrote, and I quote, and this is a good place to end our discussion of Davis, "Laws are made for the government of actions, and while they cannot interfere with mere religious belief, they may with practices." And that is the heart and soul of the belief-action or the belief-conduct distinction. Since Davis decided in 1890, the belief-action distinction or the belief-conduct distinction has remained a part of the court's doctrinal tool chest. I want to be careful here. At some points in the court's history, the belief-conduct distinction has seemed to be the primary doctrinal tool that the court has used to resolve free exercise cases. At other points in the court history, the court seems nearly to have forgotten about the distinction or alternatively to have rejected it. But nevertheless, it continues to appear and it continues to influence the court's jurisprudence, if only on a sporadic basis. Consider this, for example. That distinction, the belief-conduct distinction, was a critical part of the court's cases, the court's resolution, I should say, of the cases of Minersville versus Gabaitis, 1940, and West Virginia versus Barnett, 1943. An implicit theme, especially in the second case, was that belief-conduct distinction. Or I should say, perhaps some uncomfortableness with the court's majority opinion with the distinction. Consider for a minute what Justice Jackson said. He went out of his way to protect the flag salute. He could have taken a different approach. He might have said, these Jehovah's Witnesses children are free to believe what they like, but they may not act necessarily on it, or refuse to act, as the case may be. But that isn't the approach he took. And indeed, there really isn't any distinction in Jackson's opinion between what these young children believe and how they may act at all. But it does appear in Justice Frankfurter's dissent, as it did in Justice Frankfurter's majority opinion for the court 3 years earlier in Minersville, where he suggests, of course you may believe whatever you like. And the state doesn't actually intrude on that arena of belief. It's simply compelling you to act in particular ways. The belief-action distinction has some traction, in other words, in the first flag salute case, but appears not to have so much traction in the second flag salute case. Or consider a more recent case. In 1993, the court took up the case of the Church of the Lukumi Babalu I Incorporated versus Hialeah. Hialeah, some of you will know, is a city in the state of Florida. In this case, the court considered the constitutionality of a municipal ordinance adopted in an emergency session by the Hialeah City Council. Now, before we get into the details of that particular ordinance and why the city chose to adopt it, I'd like to elaborate a little bit on what kinds of facts were involved in this case. This case involves a kind of ritual sacrifice practiced by members of the Santeria religion. Santeria is sometimes translated as the way of the saints, and it is a religion that combines certain elements of Roman Catholicism with traditional African religious practices. One of those practices that Santeria adherents have adopted involves the ritual sacrifice of certain animals. There are over 50,000 practitioners of the Santeria religion in South Florida. One particular Santerian church purchased land in Hialeah, Florida, with the intent of establishing a place of worship. Upon hearing this, several citizens in the city of Hialeah contacted the city councilors, fearful, one supposes, of this practice, and perhaps, although this may not be the most charitable of interpretations, perhaps fearful or distrustful of having the Santerian church in their community at all. The city council responded by passing an emergency ordinance that would prohibit ritual animal sacrifice, except in certain very narrow situations. For example, if the primary purpose of the sacrifice was to consume food, that might be an exception. And of course, licensed butchers would also have an exception. Without prejudicing our understanding of what happened, most observers, and certainly a majority of the Supreme Court, concluded on these facts that the whole point, the only point, of this particular emergency ordinance was to prevent the members of the Santerian Church from establishing a place of worship in their community. Here is the opinion of the court by Justice Kennedy. He begins, and I quote, "Our review confirms that the laws in question were enacted by officials who did not understand, failed to perceive, or chose to ignore the fact that their official actions violated the nation's essential commitment to religious freedom." These are harsh words. He might have written them in a manner even more forceful and less charitable. But do not let the gentility of his phrasing keep you from seeing the harshness of his message. He has suggested that at best, these Hylias city officials were insensitive to the demands of the free exercise clause. And he goes further and suggests that they knew they were insensitive. And insensitive is a polite word for suggesting that they knew they were under an obligation under the free exercise clause to respect the Santerian practice of religion, and they chose not to fulfill their constitutional responsibilities. Now, before I go any further in this case, I said in the last lecture, when we were discussing the Lemon Test, that one rarely encounters cases where the first prong of the Lemon Test is clearly implicated. You'll recall that the first prong suggests that the primary purpose of the governmental regulation should be secular in nature. In this case, we don't have to go beyond the Lemon Test's first prong. Clearly, the purpose here was not secular. The purpose was to burden the Santeria Church. One rarely finds that kind of explicit hostility to religion. And as a consequence, one rarely finds a violation of the first prong of the Lemon Test, but this is one of these cases. Justice Kennedy continued, and I quote again, "The record in this case compels the conclusion that suppression of the central element of the Santeria worship service was the object of the ordinance." What an extraordinary thing to say. The whole point of this legislation, he writes, was to prevent the Santerian Church, the members of the Santerian Church, from engaging in ritual animal sacrifice. He continues, and I quote again, "Legislators may not devise mechanisms, overt or disguised, designed to persecute or oppress a religion or its practices. The laws here in question were enacted contrary to these constitutional principles, and they are void." Why concentrate at such length on Hialeah? I have said repeatedly that there are no easy cases in constitutional law. Hialeah might give lie to that claim. Hialeah, on some understandings at least, is a very simple case. If the record discloses unequivocally, as this record seemed to do, that city or governmental officials intend to burden a religion, that is about as easy a case as one can imagine. You don't need a fancy three-pronged Lemon Test. You don't need an endorsement test. You don't need to choose between the strict separationist understanding and the accommodationist understanding of the First Amendment to know that these sets of facts, if they are accurate, constitute a violation of the Free Exercise Clause. Surely any student of the Constitution, if they understood this record in the same way that the majority did, would reach the same conclusion. Let me continue. Why then take up Hialeah? Hialeah involves the court, the members of the court, I should say, once again in a dispute about the meaning of the Free Exercise Clause more generally, and consequently involves the members of the court once again in a dispute about what the purpose of the Free Exercise Clause is and what kinds of doctrinal tools the court ought to use to give it life. Let me continue with it in this way. There are lots of criticisms that one might advance against the court's opinion in Hialeah. Whatever the merit of those criticisms, they all tend to center upon one central feature of the court's opinion. That feature is the role of neutrality in constitutional interpretation, or I should say, the role of neutrality in understanding what the purpose of the Free Exercise Clause is. Let me try to be a little bit more explicit about what I mean by that claim. As I've said, in the Hialeah case, there was no dispute about the purpose of the law. There was no dispute, let me be more specific, that the law wasn't neutral toward religion. And in the abstract, I suppose, there is not much dispute among judges or scholars about whether neutrality is a central part of the Free Exercise Clause. Of course it is. But that concept of neutrality prompted a heated and ongoing exchange, I should say, among some of the justices on the court, especially Justices Kennedy, Souter, and to a lesser extent, Justice Scalia, about whether neutrality toward religion really is or really should be a constitutional requirement, and even more precisely, about what neutrality actually means. Consider this statement in one of the opinions by Justice Souter. I quote, "A law that is religion neutral on its face or in its purpose may lack neutrality in its effect by forbidding something that religion requires, or alternatively, by requiring something that religion forbids. A secular law applicable to all that prohibits the consumption of alcohol, for example, will affect members of religion that require the use of wine in their services." You see the problem he's getting at. He went on to use a specific example. Undoubtedly, it is the specific example that you would have mentioned as well. And I quote again, "Without an exception for sacramental wine, prohibition may fail the test of religion neutrality," close quote. Now, I want to make sure we understand this. We won't be able to understand alternative conceptions of neutrality unless we first understand precisely what Justice Souter is arguing. Neutrality, if it is a constitutional value, certainly has much to commend it. But sometimes neutral laws, or laws that appear to be neutral, either in purpose or in effect, may nevertheless have an awful consequence for specific religions, hence the prohibition example. Surely the law, the Volstead Act, that gave life to prohibition was neutral. It didn't suggest, for example, that only certain segments of society were prohibited from the consumption of alcohol. It prohibited everybody from the consumption of alcohol. That's a neutral law. It is neutral, at least, in purpose. Note how different it is than the Hialeah law, which was surely not neutral in purpose. Is its mere neutrality, especially when considered in contrast to the Hialeah case, sufficient to give it constitutional immunity? And there are some justices who argue that because neutrality is the central purpose, the central requirement of the Free Exercise Clause, that that is enough. If the prohibition law, if the Volstead Act is neutral, that is all that is necessary to satisfy the demands of the Free Exercise Clause. But as Souter has suggested, if we approach the question at that level of formal inquiry, and indeed in a different opinion he calls it a simple formalism, if we approach it in that way, we may not see the damage that is done to specific religious communities. And of course, we can all think of religious communities that do use alcohol. Their religious services may well be harmed. Indeed, their religious faith may be harmed by such a requirement of neutrality, or by, I should say, by such an understanding of neutrality. That so-called formalist understanding of neutrality might be contrasted with what some scholars call a substantive conception of neutrality. And this substantive conception of neutrality suggests that a law must, of course, be formal at the level of purpose, but it must also be neutral at the level of effect. Now, let's think about that for a minute. If a law must be neutral in effect, then we run the risk, one might argue, that a law of general applicability demands exceptions for particular adherents of particular faiths. You'll recall where we began this lecture with Justice Field's opinion in Davis versus Beeson, where he argued that the framers could never have intended an understanding of the First Amendment that would allow some individuals to opt out of the criminal law by virtue of what they believe. But yet, one understanding of neutrality might require precisely that. That is the kind of issue that drives so many of the justices to separate concurring opinions or to dissenting opinions in cases like Hialeah and in the cases that follow Hialeah. Hialeah, in other words, is an easy case because it's an exceptional case. We don't have to directly address the question of whether the law in Hialeah was neutral, because it is one of those rare cases where, of course, the law was not neutral, even in purpose, even at the level of formal neutrality. Now think about what this means for the next set of cases. Remember, a precedent looks to the past. It looks to see how judges have decided cases in the past. But a precedent also looks to the future. A precedent provides guidance, presumably, to future courts and to future judges and justices about how they ought to decide similar kinds of cases. And I asked you to consider this kind of exercise when we considered the moment of silence law. I ask you to do it again. Imagine at some point in the near future, members of the Santeria Church purchase or rent land in another community with the intent of establishing formal services and a formal church, a building, a playground, and all of the other accoutrements of a church organization. And what if the citizens of that community, let's call it so we don't prejudice any particular community, Fintown, conclude that they don't want members of the Santerian Church in their community? Now, I can assure you that the members of Fintown are well educated. Indeed, they are all lawyers. They are all constitutional scholars. And they open up their books, which would be my second choice, or, for my first choice, they load the DVD of this course in, and they understand immediately that there is one precedent of overwhelming significance, Hialeah. What lesson should they take from Hialeah? Presumably, the lesson will be, we probably are constitutionally authorized to pass a statute that will burden the Santerian Church. But we have to be careful about how we do it. We can't say that we want to burden the Santerian Church. We need to avoid the problem of the polluted record in Hialeah. We need a pristine, pure record. And in our record, in all of the hearings associated with this bill, in all of the public commentary associated with this bill, we need to point out that we don't even know there is such a thing called the Santerian Church. Lips sealed. We simply talk about the dangers associated with animal sacrifice when they are not done under the supervision of county authorities, for example, or when they're not done with the express purpose of making sure that the resulting animals are kosher or something else. In other words, we try to come up with a law that, unlike the law in Hialeah, is formally neutral. And then the court will have to address the question that Hialeah presumably left open, that question about the distinction between formal neutrality and neutrality in fact. Because as it turns out, in Fintown, the only church harmed by the law, the only church affected by the law, is the fledgling Santeria Church. The law is neutral at the level of formal neutrality, neutral in purpose, at least so far as we can tell, but it's not neutral in fact. It significantly burdens this church. What will a court do there? Let me tell you one thing a court cannot do. It cannot say the following. I know there is no reference to the Santerian Church in the formal record surrounding the passage of this legislation. I know that there is no concrete evidence that suggests that the members of the fine community of Fintown were opposed to the Santerian Church. But I know in my heart what is really going on here. I know, like any person of ordinary common sense knows, that the whole point was to shut down the Santerian Church. Why can the court not do that? Do you remember the doctrine of comity that we addressed several lectures ago? Comity is that principle that suggests that the court owes a certain degree of respect to all other governmental actors. The court may never inquire into motive, in part because it is difficult, as I discussed before, to get evidence about motive, to understand motive in any comprehensive, meaningful way. A basic principle of any constitutional democracy is that we presume, or that governmental institutions, governmental actors, presume fidelity to the Constitution. We don't presume the worst about other governmental actors. In the absence of any specific evidence, it would be constitutionally illegitimate for any judge to write the opinion that I have just outlined for you. Now, this topic of neutrality, this distinction between formal neutrality And practical or substantive neutrality is precisely the issue that we will take up in our next lecture.